For those who are new to this human, Hugh Newman, he is a host of Megalithomania Annual Conference. He is a crop circle investigator, a author of a book called Earth Grids, and some books about giants. So before we get into all this stuff about giants, which is what I want to talk to you about, briefly, because I'm curious, I read your book about Earth Grids, and I also love visiting crop circles, and every time I go look at different crop circles, what I see are your photos on all of the different crop circle websites. So before we get into the giants, I just want to ask you, so Earth Grids, what's the deal going on there? We have grids of, like, energy lines on the Earth and also on other planets. What the hell are they? What do we do with them? Why do we care about them? What's going on with all of that?
The Earth Grids thing, that is actually, through crop circles, I got into that subject. It really is based upon the idea of, like, the Earth mysteries, like ley lines, Earth energies. I'm very interested in things like cymatics and the way that kind of we interact with these sites specifically, you know, like, because I always felt like there was some kind of effect people get when they visit ancient sites. I always got that, and I always looked out for that. And still to this day, I have very strange things happen, whether it's very scary kind of hauntings or whether it's like enlightening kind of light-filled experiences. And I think when you're looking at the concept of Earth Grids, it covers many different subjects. There's not just like one like Earth Grid around the planet with all these lines connecting up with this energy system. I think there's more to it than that. There's elements we don't understand. There's a global kind of sense of this magnetic field and the way that gets manipulated by the movement of the sun and the different planets, and it kind of forms really into this kind of cymatic effect around the planet. And I think that that's something that's often overlooked, and that affects us, and that affects the ancient people who were building these sites and trying to manipulate this energy from the magnetic field, from the telluric currents, from the natural yang chi earth energies that occur on the planet, also the underground water. And also they were masters, these ancient builders, I believe, of manipulating the weather. I think that was one of their skill sets. That's one of the things we go into in the new book, actually, the whole Sowers of Thunder mythos. And so when you're looking at Earth Grids, it's really like, it's like a concept. You know, there's many different angles to look at it from.
Okay, but so when you're saying energy grids, you're talking about magnetic sort of lines within the Earth. Is this something we can actually measure? Is it something that, you know, orthodox science understands and can measure, or is this something very different?
Well, yeah, I mean, orthodox science can measure, like, telluric currents. They're linked with the magnetic field, and they kind of surge and increase in the morning when the sun rises. They become stronger and, like, thicker, and they move across the landscape, and often that's what wakes us up in the morning. And then they decrease in strength at night and become thinner and smaller, almost disappear into nothing. But these telluric currents exist like 3 feet below the surface and just above the surface. So these are real things. It's all documented. And the fact is, it's not really talked about. No one really discusses it. But it's a well-known kind of thing that's been observed, I believe, for thousands of years. People have been able to sense this through not just their body, but through dowsing, through psychic means and other such things, because it affects the glands in the brain. It affects, you can feel like kind of shivers in your body. Yeah, and dowsers basically can pick these up quite easily. There's technologies can. There's apps on your phone that can do it now. And so, yeah, this is well known, but it's just not really talked about. I mean, because it was more of a kind of, because it's invisible, it's often not discussed. That's basically it.
Okay. And so do they tie in with crop circles? And also with crop circles, I know obviously you seem to be an expert on them because you're photographing them everywhere. What's your take on them? Because they're absolutely...
Well, yeah, I mean, the prehistory of crop circles is really interesting. And in more recent times, I know for a fact many of them are man-made. That's just a fact nowadays. It's like, in a way, these people who make them, they're like fantastic artists. They're continuing a tradition. But there are some anomalies. There are ones that no one claims to have made them. There's a prehistory that goes back literally hundreds of years all over the world. And there's no way people were hoaxing them then, you know, for sure. And so when it was a kind of big thing in the 80s and 90s, there were scientific tests done on some of the circles. And they proved, you know, through scientific means and technologies, that some kind of electromagnetic energy was heating up the stems and increasing the kind of nodes, sort of expanding them, blowing them up almost, burning them out in some cases. So some kind of energy was causing that, some kind of microwave or electrical or magnetic kind of intensity. And so that kind of, that's what got me interested in this. And then I realized they were often linked with these sacred sites, these megalithic sites, always in the same landscape, especially around here in Wiltshire. And so, yeah, when you look at it from that perspective, you realize there's something subtle going on that's been observed for hundreds of years. But nowadays, the complicated ones and everything else, there's a lot of man-made ones. One of the things that really interested me was the work of John Burke and Kaj Helberg, who worked for the BLT research team in Boston. And they were analysing crop circles and were noticing these blown nodes, but also where the crop circles had appeared one year, the following year, they would notice that the crops would grow more abundantly, like the land had been affected, like the seeds, the crops had actually been affected by whatever energy, or these, what they think were these spheres of light, which have often been witnessed in films, that created them. And so there's a very strange phenomena which links with fairy lore as well, which is a whole other thing.
So that's what I was going to ask, is when you say these balls of light that created them, is it the Earth that's creating them? Is it aliens, UFOs, fairies? What's your take?
Well, this is one of the really frustrating aspects of when you're studying anything kind of paranormal, is there's an element of what Patrick Harper called daemonic reality. John Michell spoke about this as well, where you never quite get the answers. You get near to the answers, and then another level of complexity emerges, and you're back to square one. And so this is one of these. This is like the UFO phenomenon. This is like the Bigfoot. This is like fairies, or witches and things like that. You never quite get the answer. So I think the same principles are at play with these balls of light, because they appear intelligent, you know. And we, to be honest with you, we've seen stuff around here, you know, directly. I've seen stuff myself. JJ's seen it.
When you say stuff, you're talking about balls of light?
Balls of light, strange movements through the landscape and things like this, electrical activity around sites.
For context, for people listening, by the way, we are literally right next to Stonehenge, maybe a couple hundred metres away or something like that.
Yeah, about half a mile. But we're literally next to one of the mounds. I mean, we're in the Stonehenge landscape, right in the heart of it here. The address here is, you know, part of the Stonehenge landscape complex kind of thing. So there's a lot of strange stuff going on here for obvious reasons, but also a place like Avebury and all over the country, really. And so you've got to kind of question what is going on. I mean, why are these balls of light being filmed? I mean, what really are they? I mean, they could be elemental beings. There's so much talk about this in the prehistory, especially in Ireland and places like this. But also, we get it everywhere. There's these stories of these strange lights and circular kind of things occurring in the crops all over the world, fairy rings and so forth. And so, yes, I think there's a lot more of this to the meets the eye. Trying to kind of pin it down as to exactly what it is, I think will always elude us.
So when we're talking about this realm of other things, you're talking about fairies and pixies and aliens and whatever. So you've written a book, well, now two books about giants, and the new one's just come out, by the way, for people listening. Please check out the book.
There's the book.
That's the one. So you've written a book about giants. Now we were talking about fairies and whatever. So before I read your book, my concept and understanding of giants, I sort of was something mythical. I lumped them in with werewolves and vampires and zombies and unicorns and all that kind of stuff. So when you decide to look into this, you know, you go on Google, you start looking at giants, what you get are images of hoaxes, just endless hoaxes. And you know, there was this Photoshop competition a while ago where people were putting images of giants in the ground, and that's what spread all around. And so obviously there's a lot of bad reporting about that out there. Some people saying they're giants, but they're just nonsense websites, just basing off Photoshop competitions and stuff. So your book has hundreds of reports of reports of skeletons mainly. And they're mostly from contemporary newspapers from, you know, through the 19th century. So why should we believe their reports? Why not assume that they're all also hoaxes and, you know, part of some fantasy like unicorns?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. There's like, well, in North America specifically, I mean, in the book, we cover in our previous book, Giants on Record, we've got 250 accounts we put in the book. We had probably at that time 1,200 accounts. Now we have nearly 2,000. And we're not just talking newspapers. We're talking antiquarian journals, archaeological reports, the Smithsonian's own archaeologists digging stuff up, reporting on up to 8-foot tall skeletons. We have some that are on display in places like the Maryland Museum and universities. And we have numerous, like, obscure town and county histories that report these doctors and surgeons examining these skeletons that have been dug out of a mound 9 feet tall. And they're measuring them, and they're just putting them in the back end of this tiny local book that no one's ever going to find, apart from us, in these obscure libraries and archives. And so why would they do that? You know, this is one of the big questions. And also we have literally, you know, tens, maybe dozens of accounts of actual kind of photos when they were on display. You know, and then the problem is the Smithsonian disappeared, most of them. And this is part of a lengthy agenda to link with manifest destiny, the theory of evolution emerging, religious beliefs and so forth. But also in 1990, we have the NAGPRA Act, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, came into force, where the indigenous Native Americans, working with the federal government, basically got all their grave goods, skeletons, any bones that were on display anywhere, to rebury them in a sacred manner, which is a good thing, you know, don't get me wrong, but it also a problem for us giantologists, we call ourselves. We couldn't, all the evidence disappeared with that. But we know that there's a huge amount of academic data that we compiled. If you just look at the academic data and the measurements and the discoveries, that's enough to push this open and to, you know, get them to explain this in the mainstream, but they never will and never have. And so, you know, the fact is that there's just too many accounts. And like we realized with working with people like Ross Hamilton, who's written a book called A Tradition of Giants, Jeffrey Wilson, and a few other authors and researchers, that there's something going on, and like it's not been documented. And we just became compelled to investigate, why is this being covered up?
But obviously you find all these accounts, but but we got to examine the credibility of them. So are they all clustered in one area? Is it just a bunch of farmers getting together and you know, getting in on a hoax together for some fame and success? Could it be that? And then also the newspapers that were reporting them, did they have high journalistic standards? Were they also reporting vampires and unicorns? I mean, you know.
That's fine. That's a fair question. No. This was like New York Times, Los Angeles Times. These were like major national newspapers at the time. There was obviously a lot of local papers as well. But we're talking about obscure diaries we found and things like that from academics that were describing what they found in detail, measuring everything. And so we cut, you know, can you dismiss those as just like, are they going to make that up and never to publish it? And so, you know, we leave it up to the reader to decide on the authenticity. We're just trying to, we investigate every account to its core the best we can. Sometimes it's a dead end, you can't go any further. Sometimes the Smithsonian disappeared them, others got taken by NAGPRA. And so we're not pushing an agenda. We don't, you know, we're not 100% sure all these discoveries, but we document the most authentic we feel ones and put those in the book.
But like, for example, with the farmers, is it just one area? Is it spread out through the whole country?
Oh, yeah, the whole country. No, it's the entire country of North America that we investigated. From one, you know, from Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, up in Maine, all the way down to Catalina Island in the far kind of southwest regions of California. So every area, and we're talking thousands of miles distance, when there was no communication, there was no post, there were no trains, nothing like that at the time. All of these reports coming out in local areas. And so, you have to take notice of that, especially as the Native Americans themselves were already talking about this. They were talking about these giants. They were aware of them. They were their ancestors. They were also describing an earlier group of people. They didn't know who they were, had arrived in the area and terrorized them and things like this. So we look at mythology as well, and we're finding parallels across the entire country, not just in the mythology, but also in the discoveries and the descriptions. They're almost identical, some of them.
But, you know, again, in terms of credibility, okay, so you've got a bunch of farmers, you've got some newspapers reporting that. Are there any figures from history that stand out, that you know, are esteemed and well-regarded?
Yeah, no, well, there's a lot. The names are all in the book. I forget some of the names, but we have probably 25 well-known academics in universities that are reporting on this, doctors and surgeons. Some of the early presidents reported on discovering bones and skeletons, as well as meeting actual 7.5 foot tall Osage Indians, you know, at the time. And they were kind of blown away with these people they were just meeting. We have many of the early explorers as well. We have Sir Francis Drake. We have Magellan down in Patagonia. We have numerous, like John Smith up in the kind of Carolinas and so forth.
And what were those guys saying, Francis Drake and Magellan and John Smith?
Yeah, no, they were meeting them directly.
And when you say them, what were they meeting?
They were meeting very, very tall Native Americans, up to 7-8 feet tall. There was a 9 foot, I mean, they claim to have met 9 foot kind of giants in the 1500s. This is where, you know, we document this quite clearly in the book, and I can't imagine they would lie or exaggerate, but again, we leave it to the reader to kind of make their own decisions, because we're just documenting what we find.
And so, you know, when we're talking about giants, obviously you've written these books about giants. How big are we talking when we say giants? Is it 7 foot? Are these 100 foot Godzillas? You know, what kind of size are we talking about here?
No, well, in a giants on record, we cover between 7 foot and 18 foot, but the 18 foot one is a bit dodgy. We're not sure about that, but generally. And this is, I've talked to like people like Dr. Greg Little about this in detail. He's looked into this as well. And we're talking 7 to 9 foot is the realistic kind of size range we're dealing with here. And we're talking like not pituitary gigantism, not acromegaly, nothing like that. Genuine genetic giants who are just this big, found throughout America, focused heavily in the Ohio, West Virginia area. That's where the real hub is.
And the biggest reputable report, I mean, you said an 18-foot is...
The 18-foot one we're not sure about, but it's quite fun to put it in the book. We put it in there anyway. I think that's from Texas.
Oil City Times, 1870.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah, yeah. And but there are a few 12-footers that are very kind of, you know, mentioned, that are really clearly written and described and measured. And we're like, hang on a sec, you know. That's kind of intriguing.
And when you say these 12 footers, you're talking, is this reputable sources, New York Times, Smithsonian, that kind of thing? Or is that...
Yeah, well, I can't, off the top of my head, I'd have to check my data in my book. But there were a few that kind of surprised us, up to, I think, 11 foot six. There was a couple that kind of seemed really reputable. There's a 10 foot one, I think, discovered by a well-known person in Ohio, a well-known kind of academic who was quite stunned by that. And all the measurements kind of matched someone being 10 foot. I think it was a broken up skeleton. So you've got things like that going on. It's like, but then you look at the deep prehistory, and we have examples of Homo heidelbergensis in South Africa that go back, 200,000 years, maybe 300,000 years. And some of these are between 7 and 10 feet tall.
I've never heard of Homo heidelbergensis. I don't know how you pronounce that. Is this a primate species?
This is a predecessor to the Denisovans. The Denisovans are actually ancestors of them. And now it's now thought the Denisovans were giants as well. That's the kind of story. And so they really intrigued. This is like, I think, Professor Francis Thackeray and Lee Berger, who are scientists down in the South African University, found some bones, some fossilized thigh bones, which would have matched someone 10 feet tall. They're definite 7 and 8 footers they found down there. And so that proves humans were around that big. So it kind of like, you know, removes the kind of possibility of them, you know, not being a reality, that, you know, they were certainly that tall.
But okay, so is it not possible or even likely that these bones that were found are... literally, you know, Gigantopithecus, or this, what do you say, Homo hydro... blah, blah, blah.
Heidelbergensis, yeah.
Heidelbergensis.
I don't think so. No, these are like... these have been analysed. Yeah, they're humanoid, yeah.
They don't have, like, ape-like craniums. They have full human craniums.
I don't think so that long ago. No, not 300,000 years ago. I think they were different to us, yeah. But it just shows you that they were, you know... human types around, you know, that height. It's kind of, that kind of intrigued us when we spotted that.
But so, I mean, we know that Gigantopithecus, for example, existed. That was a 10-foot ape. It was the biggest ape, I think, the biggest primate. Is it not possible that all of these giant skeletons that have been found were actually just Gigantopithecus or some other unknown ape that was maybe either, you know, mistaken by the archaeologists or perhaps even by Native Americans? They dug it up and went, oh God, there's some ancient king here. Let's bury him with our dudes.
No.
How come?
Because these were clearly humans, the ones in America.
They're just definitely not primates.
No, because they're clearly humans. Yeah.
So do they have other features that separate them from normal humans? Are they humans completely identical to humans, but just really tall? Do they have something different about them?
Not really. No, I mean, we have some accounts of extremely wide, powerful jaws. That's what Dr. Donald Dragoo called the Adena jaw, and there was something quite different. It was really robust, and you could almost fit it around your fat, you know, a normal person's face. We have accounts of double rows of teeth, which kept coming up, or supernumerary teeth, extra teeth, which is a genetic kind of throwback, and that we found many accounts of that. And we talked to a dental anthropologist, I think, called Shara Bailey from New York University, and she suggested, well, actually, that could happen, because once you get to a certain size, you the jaws were so big that you kind of naturally, nature would fill up the space with teeth, and so you'd get extra rows of teeth, you know, things like this. And so that was quite interesting when we spoke to her, because she kind of admitted that could be a possibility.
So you know, with that being the case, are we looking at a different species or maybe a different race, you know, just through genetic mutations of Homo sapiens, or is this definitely not just some random tall dudes spread out through time and space, that, you know, a long history of burials?
No, I think they're just humans, yeah. Just different. There's lots of different types of humans today, like there were back then, I think, somewhere. I think with in North America, especially with the Maung culture groups, they kind of, the elites kept themselves separate from the kind of commoners, if you like, the kind of, you know, the villages. They kept their own small villages next door, and they would only breed, but this is what the kind of many of the traditions state, and Ross Hamilton's kind of discussed that with us, is that they would breed between themselves and other elite groups. So they would maintain their giant genes through history.
Okay, so then it's not so much a race. Is it a race? Would you call it a race? Is it just tribes,
so.
Basically?
No, I think it's just, you know, interbreeding with specific very tall people and maintaining those genes. I think that's what it was partly. But we have traditions in North America that go back, that talk of a time, and this is from you know, various kind of Native American scholars that I know Ross Hamilton was involved with, and they say that even back to the time before the Younger Dryas, there was talk of this megafauna, these giant animals that would terrorize people, but there was also giant humans back then. And it was just a matter-of-fact thing recorded in the native traditions and the native stories about their history. And so when we kind of found out about that, we were quite intrigued. But then when, after these so-called Younger Dryas, or what they called the sort of Dark Tent, this was a period of a few hundred or a thousand years where everything went bad, dark, everything died off, the Clovis people died off, and so forth. They talk about that not only did the megafauna shrink, so did the humans, but only a few of the tall ones survived, and they tried to maintain their traditions for thousands of years and breed in between themselves to maintain their status as such. That's the kind of loose traditions we piece together about this. There's also great battles that took place between these different peoples according to their stories, and there is actually archaeological evidence, according to our research, that backs that up as well. And so it's quite a profound missing chapter in, you know, American history, and it's not something just us we've been doing. There's a whole bunch of people have been going into this, coming at it from different angles, you know. So yeah, it's very intriguing.
So your take on it is basically that there are a few random tall people who are possibly survivors of an ancient race of tall people, and then they selectively bred and created tribes of tall people. Is that
very vaguely? But I don't think that's, because you look at the size of America, we're talking about a continent, really. We're not talking about one country, so whole areas wouldn't even have any connection with their other areas, so you can't really generalize in that sense. But certainly in some cases I believe so, yeah.
The thing is, though, you have cases going all the way down from southern Chile, all the way up into, you know, way up in North America. So is the idea that that selective breeding is what created these tribes of people?
That I don't know about. I mean, in some cases, yeah, but in other cases, it just seems like that there were very tall people around, and like, you know, not in the majority or anything, but they just happen to be pockets where this would occur. Where that came from, we don't know. It just is a very strange thing. But, you know, you look at places like, I went to Tonga once a few years ago, and everyone there is really tall. And I was like, wow, you know, the women, the men, everyone, the kids, everyone's taller than everyone in Britain virtually. It's like, wow. And so you realize that it can happen anywhere on the planet. And so it's just like one of these things. But with this Denisovan stuff that's coming out, I think that's where a lot of kind of data is going to emerge, you know, and like kind of prove that could, because we're finding in North America, Denisovan DNA in like, especially the northern areas and going into Canada, where a lot of these very early accounts of these so-called giants came from. And so the fact is their genes appear to be linked with the giants of North America.
So as far as we're aware, if you look up Denisovans now on you know, Google or whatever, they seem to be suggesting they're quite small people, but having giant teeth for some reason.
Yeah, I know.
So your supposition is that they were giants, and
well, I mean, skull fragments, the finger bones, and the teeth are all extremely large. They're pretty much the only things they've got. And then they found this dragon skull in China, which has been around for a while, but only been reported on the last few months, really. And that's huge. That's of someone probably 7 to 8 feet tall. And they think that could be Denisovan.
Dragon skull, did you say?
The dragon man skull.
Okay.
Yeah, this is quite a kind of well-known thing. I know Andrew Collins and myself did a whole kind of interview about that, because we were like, wow, what is this? Could that be the first Denisovan skull that's been found? I know Graham's talked about it as well in quite detail. And so the fact is, you're finding, you know, suddenly out of nowhere, this fairly large, you know, someone 7 or 8 feet tall perhaps, suddenly it's there, and like, but they won't do any tests on it, so we can't tell if it's Denisovan or not. So we're waiting on that. We'll see what happens with that.
Okay, so when the European explorers went over to North America, they were much shorter than they are today. I think in the book you said they were 5'4". They were going and seeing these Native American dudes who were probably a lot healthier, better diet, better nutrition, better lifestyle, and so they were bigger. Could not most of the giant stories be that, just the sort of like looking at people who are just bigger than them because they're healthier than them, or
No, not really. I mean, if you look at the kind of reports of like Tuscaloosa and his son and things like that in the southern, I think the Florida, the southern areas, they were describing something quite different to just being slightly taller. Mm. There was a case where the tribal leader, Tuscaloosa, he was sitting on a horse and his feet, almost his ankles, were dragging on the ground, you know, compared to everyone else who was riding a horse normally. And so you get things like that, these little descriptions, like, what? You know?
But so, I mean, we always have tall people, like, you know, the NBA is full of, they're like, you know, Shaq, Yao Ming, is like the 7'9" players. If you look on Wikipedia, the lists 21 people over 8 feet, you know, a couple of them close to 9 feet. I think the percentage of people over 7 foot today is 0.000038. So it's not very common, but it does happen. But they're all normal people, you know, they're not giants, they're just normal people who mutated. And often it's the case because of this, you know, pituitary gland issues and the human growth hormone abundance and all that kind of stuff. You were saying that you don't think that can explain this, that these aren't just pituitary malfunctions, that these are people.
Yeah, because you know, generally, it's, I mean, I'm not a kind of doctor or anything, you know, but from our research, it's clear that these were robust, fully formed, naturally kind of natural dimensions of a human. They weren't tall and skinny, or they didn't have signs of things like what you're talking about, gigantism or acromegaly or anything like that. There's no evidence of that in most of the accounts, and also when these explorers were meeting them, these were like robust. They described them as almost like being like warriors. They were just perfectly formed and proportioned in every way. There's nothing strange, you know. And like with a lot of these so-called basketball players, they're kind of tall and skinny. That isn't any of the descriptions we get where they're tall and skinny and things like this. It's quite different. And so I think it's a different thing. Yeah, quite different. And we kind of concluded that in our book.
I mean, there are some big, also, you know, chunky guys in the NBA. Shaquille O'Neal is a famous guy, but they are very few and far between. So you know, this covers a lot of time. We've got thousands of years of burials potentially. So it's unlikely, you're saying, that can account for all of these bodies. I guess during that time there was also a lot lower human populations.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there were normal sized people, but in North America it's odd. There's just too many accounts. It's too many reports and from obscure places. And if you look at the data and the statistics of that, it's quite strange. There's just too many to like ignore. And so, you know, we were just compelled by it, and we thought, we have to report on this. We have to just put this out there as a thing and see what people think. And then we have, people like I said, Ross Hamilton, Dr. Greg Little, who've been researching it in America for a long time, and they're saying exactly the same things. So they're just like, there's giant artifacts that are being found as well, and things like this.
When you say artifacts, what are you?
We're talking giant axe heads and things. I've actually seen some, I've actually held some before. They're absolutely ridiculous, you know, like 36 pounds, you know, way too heavy to kind of wield, you know, for a modern person. But yeah, no, we're compelled by it. We think there's something in it. And I wish it would be taken more seriously by academia, because it was taken seriously when it all began. The early Smithsonian people were documenting it and describing, measuring and reporting in their own physical annual reports, these giant books. We've got a couple of them. Jim's got them in America that just describe, we found an 8-foot skeleton, we found a 7.5-foot, here are the measurements, we found it in this mound.
I mean, you have some 12-foot with the Smithsonian as well, I believe, if I remember correctly. But this is the thing. So many accounts of it within the book end with, something like that the bones were shipped back to the Smithsonian for further study. So you're saying you want people to take, you want academia to take this giant thing more seriously. I think the reason they don't is because of the lack of hard evidence. There is no skeleton that we can go to refer to and say, well, there's a bloody giant.
That is part of it, but there's also agendas at play as well, and there have been for a long time.
So, yeah, exactly. So what was going on? Why is that the last we hear of these skeletons that were shipped back to the Smithsonian?
Well, the problem is mainly in 1990 when NAGPRA came in. That's the main thing. That removed anything else, you know, that was on display. But we have agendas at play. We have, obviously, they were championing the theory of evolution. There was Smithsonian at the forefront of that, actually. And also we have the whole story of manifest destiny, this kind of racist agenda to remove the Native Americans, shove them onto reservations and claim they're subhuman and things like this. And so when you've got these kind of things at play, if you suddenly find a 10-foot skeleton with a 36-inch circumference skull with double rows of teeth found in these beautiful geometric, astronomically aligned mounds, it doesn't fit with what you want, and you can't take over. You know, they're clearly the incoming white people aren't superior to them. These are superior people. These are amazing people, and so they couldn't publish that. I didn't want that to be public because it didn't. That means they couldn't take over the land. They couldn't take over and push these Native Americans onto reservations and things like that. So you got that kind of very racist, money-grabbing, land-grabbing agenda taking place, which is the fundamental root, you know, the kind of root cause of many of the problems in North America. And so you got that going on. You've also got, they were reporting on these things for many years until a gentleman called Alice Hedlicka came in, and he was... he actually was kind of into eugenics and things like that. This was like before the Second World War, in the early 1900s, 1920s and so forth. And he put a stop to it and made claims. There was this claim going around that this superior race were present in North America before the Native Americans, and who were they? And they put a close to that. They claimed giants were no more. They actually put headlines out in papers, press releases, claiming giants never exist. They were all mismeasurements. They were all wrong. Now, so when you've got like authorities like that having to put things out like that in the 1910s and 20s, that raises a few questions, because, okay, they're trying to closed that down, but what are they closing down? And all the evidence is all there in the Smithsonian's own reports. And so, yeah, it's a very interesting kind of intrigue, you know, going on here.
So the guy's name?
Ailes Hedlička.
Hedlička. So I think in the book you were talking about him possibly being a white supremacist, and it's also...
In a manner of speaking, a eugenicist. He was into eugenics and the sort of Nazi philosophies that developed from that kind of, from that time. You know, trying to make the white man superior, basically. That's basically what that was, the kind of agenda at play. It's part of the previous Manifest Destiny agenda was similar to that in some senses, trying to push these Native Americans who they claimed were savages, which they weren't, clearly.
So the Smithsonian collected all of these skeletons from all over the country. Every time a skeleton was found, it would go to them for further study. They'd go in a closet, and then this guy, Hedlička, came in and he...
Well, no, it wasn't just him. I think it was happening before him as well, and it really peaked with him being there. But, you know, people would, like, have their stuff collected by the Smithsonian, like a bone or a skeleton or a skull they found, and they would contact the Smithsonian and say, hey, can I get it back now? Can I, you know, what's happened with it? Oh, we've got no record of it. And that would be the general thing. There's no record of it. It'd be disappeared completely.
So I can buy the idea that a Smithsonian were doing this part of some conspiracy to, you know, help along Manifest Destiny, kick the Indians out of their, into the reservations, all of that kind of stuff. That all makes sense. But you know, if this isn't just a unicorn-like fantasy based on a load of, you know, staggering number of hoaxes and bad reporting, then there's got to be a lot of giant skeletons hidden in many closets, you know. So you talked about this NAGBRA thing. Maybe they were all, you know, reburied in 1990. But between 1910 and 1990, I think Manifest Destiny had pretty much been let go of, and also. The head of the Smithsonian was probably not a eugenicist between those times. So why didn't he let it go, for one? And two, America is not the only place with giants. And it's, you know, not just the USA. I mean, all over the Americas and the rest of the world. So where are all those skeletons? What's going on?
Yeah, well, in North America, I mean, literally there were ones on display in, like, that. I know there was one in a dentist or a barber shop, I think, somewhere in New England, in Vermont. And this was, like, I think, an 8.5-foot skeleton. It was just there for many years until, you know, and people didn't care about it. You know, that was that. There's a photograph of one from Steelville, I think, Missouri, which was, I think, 9 feet tall, just laying down next to someone. We found it on a microfilm. And that was reported on. And so, yeah, there's a whole bunch. There was some bones and skeletons on display at the Maryland Academy of Sciences until 1990. And people just weren't interested, basically. There was no interest. I don't think there was any interest in it. They just thought they were anomalies and left it at that. There's a few people wrote about them back then, like Brad Steiger and a couple of other kind of researchers. But no one really thought much about it. There was some on display, actual kind of full burials, kind of turned into a museum, like mounds and stuff down in Moundsville, I think, and places like that. I forget which exact state that's in, but, you know, so, and they were just lying there, kind of kept, and you could see them through the glass and stuff like that. So you got things like that, and there's postcards of these as well. But it's, the thing is, like, many of them were like 7 foot, 8 foot, and you know, unless you're kind of analysing them and measuring them, it's hard to tell, you know, I think, how big they really were. I mean, in Britain, we've got just very few on display. There's the Bird Castle Giant up in Norfolk, which is, I think, just over 7 foot. There's another 7-footer on display at Thirsk Museum in Yorkshire. There was another one in St Albans, which I think was just under 7 foot. I think it's still on display there. And so there are a few here and there, but many of them were found so long ago, and there's a thing about kind of having human remains on display, especially in North America, is technically illegal. That is a problem, you know. So we've kind of got highly frustrated by that side of it, to be honest with you.
But so in America, we have just a massive, massive number of these skeletons, which goes beyond the statistical likelihood of them being over 7 foot, which is the 0.00038. But in you know, these ones in the rest of the world, like in the UK. Are they so few and far between that this could just be the, you know, the hypertrophy of the pituitary gland, HGH, all of that kind of stuff? Or again, is it a kind of a race or a tribe or even a species of,
yeah,
of giants?
Well, in Britain, yeah, it's a bit, we're such a small country here, but it's such a large, kind of long time frame as well. It's quite a challenge to kind of get your head around it, because many of these are found literally at megalithic sites, some of them are found at Iron Age sites, other ones are found at Mesolithic sites. So there's like thousands of years you're playing with here. And we have like, if it's actual tribes, we don't know. But what we find fascinating is the traditions, especially of in Wales and places like this, where they've maintained these stories, which often I believe in code truth. I mean, there's evidence now that they found like the stories of Jack and the Giants. Jack the Giant Killer could be 5,000 years old. There's like scientific report done on that, I think 2 or 3 years ago. And, you know, on St. Michael's Mount, where he was supposed to have existed, for instance, and he battled with this giant called Cormoran and defeated him there. On St. Michael's Mount in the early 1800s, they found an 8-foot skeleton inside the mount underneath the crypt. And this was documented. It's actually in, I got it up there, this National Trust archaeological report talking about it. And so you get things like that. It's like, what the hell, you know? So you've got these legends and you've got the giants in the same place, actual skeletons. And so that kind of intrigues me. There was a 10-foot giant skull on display at Keswick Museum for a long time. That was well documented. There was a giant rib up there. The list goes on. But whether they were actual tribes, it's really hard to tell. But there's been, like in America, we found burials where a majority of the people there are very, very tall compared to normal size. So, you know, it's just so random. It's really hard to kind of gauge, because obviously lots has not been discovered. Lots hasn't been reported upon. And we don't know what's been exaggerated and what hasn't. And so we're just like we did with our previous book, we're just analysing the data, going as deep as we can. We're trying to see if there's any truth in this. I mean, we've put a whole load, like we did in our previous book, we've debunked some very famous ones, like the Irish giant, the 12-foot Antrim giant. We completely debunked that very easily, actually, once you start looking into it. So we've gone into each and every account and tried to debunk them. And some you can't, some you find more evidence. And so you're like, oh, there's other reports, there's other people witnessed this. You know, and you've got people like, you know, like in Salisbury, just near Stonehenge, just near here. You've got people like Sir Thomas Elliot, who was like a well-known scholar, antiquarian. He wrote the Dictionary of All Things. He was a member of Parliament for Cambridge. He witnessed and wrote about a 14-foot, 10-inch skeleton found just down the road from here in the early 1500s, probably 1508, we think. This was also written about and reported on by William Camden. Also, John Leland talked about it as well. These were very famous scholars, writers at the time. And so that really surprised us, you know, things like that. And then you have similar kind of stories like that around the whole country. It's like, but when you get incredibly famous people at the time, highly respected people, they're not going to just ruin their reputation by making stuff up. So that's what really compelled us when you start seeing that in the historical record.
And yet, okay, so that exists. We have this historical record. We have skeletons. They're even on display in some places. The mainstream archaeological, you know, societies, whatever, they seem to have not paid this any attention at all. They either don't care or specifically ignoring it. Why should people care? Why is it important to care about giants?
Well, I think that's,
why not just regard them as, you know, freak anomalies that just happen to be?
Right? I think most people do see them as freak anomalies. I think that's a kind of general kind of rule. But we're just fascinated because it's like a missing kind of part of our human history. It's part of us. You know, we're probably related to these people who were living back then. So I think it's worth taking note and just observing it as an interesting sideline. You know, we're not trying to force it upon anybody. We're not saying believe us, we think we're right. You know, we're just documenting everything we can, going deep into it, see what we can find, debunking quite a lot of it, to be honest with you. But there's a lot we couldn't debunk, and I don't think anyone else can. It's like really interesting, but there's very little evidence to work with. And so this is why we like it when people like Thomas Elliot kind of specifically make measurements. And they even talk about finding there was like a strange book discovered in the burial that had this inscription on it. None of them could decode, not even Thomas Elliot, who was a well-known scholar. And there was this metal disc made of tin and lead with these unusual foreign inscriptions on it found in nearby. And so we're like, and this is back in the early 1500s. So you got things like that. It's like, what the hell? Then you got the National Trust reporting on an 8-foot skeleton. It's just utterly strange. I mean, here on Lundy Island, out in the Bristol Channel, we've got an 8-foot-7-inch skeleton reported on, documented by 20 different publications, at least, maybe 25. Academics were out there checking it out and stuff like that. Where's the skeleton now? We don't know. But it's the same thing everywhere. So we find anomalies, but, you know, the burials often as well are interesting because they appear to be highly revered people, like people of valor, warriors, priestly elites, traditions of them being like, you know, like with Idris we find in Wales, like a holy astronomer, you know, that he would reign from his mountain top, things like this, and measure the land. And we're finding connections between different subjects that we started this interview with, to do with geomancy and earth energies and ley lines, all connected with the myths and stories of these giants. Like, for instance, I'll just tell you this, because Idris, who's like he was a great king, he was supposed to be a king of Wales in the 6th century AD, but also in earlier traditions he was known as Idris Gower, the giant Idris. Idris translates as Enoch, and he was supposed to be on this seat, Idris's seat, Cadair Idris, this mountain in North Wales in Snowdonia, where he would survey the land, be able to prophesize everything from when the world began to when the world ends, using astronomical principles. So you have these myths, and then they found, actually, at the base of the mountain in the 1600s, 2 7-foot skeletons, and one of them was buried with this hazel rod, which is traditionally a dowsing tool. And so you've got this geomantic connection directly being found in burials, linked with these myths, and it all just kind of starts seeing that there's a pattern here. And so I think it's worth looking at these myths, especially these kind of ones that have been passed down for thousands of years, especially now there's proof of that with the Jack and the Giant stories. So yeah, so you got things like that, and so you're finding these mythological stories, like on St. Michael's Mount, even at Stonehenge, for instance, as well. You know, you've got Idris, obviously, but Stonehenge, that the earliest name of Stonehenge was the Giant's Dance, or Quia Gigantum in Welsh, which means the Giant's Dance, or the Giants. So in other slight variation, it's the Council of the Giants. But then, you know, why is it called that? And why is it said, back in the 1100s, in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, that giants brought the stones from North Africa to Ireland originally, then Merlin brought them over to Stonehenge? It's got a giant connection there. There's also a tradition written about in 1666 by Reverend Robert Gay, who lived in Nettlecombe, Somerset, and he wrote that a tribe called the Kanjig Giants created and built Stonehenge as a trophy to their kind of battle that they won, and actually built it with them. So you've got multiple traditions of giants keep being linked with Stonehenge. And also in Salisbury, not just Thomas Eliot talking about a 14-foot-10-inch skeleton. Since 1447, I think, they've been parading a 22 or 24-foot effigy of a giant around Salisbury every year just after the summer solstice. So why on earth are they doing that? And then it became known as St. Christopher. And everyone was like, who's St. Christopher? So we go into this in the book, the new book, and we realise, actually this is the article on the website we put for the Graham Hancock website, and we realised that St. Christopher, the name that it was given, who's now been decanonised, was a giant, 18-foot-tall Canaanite giant from the Bible lands, who was famous for carrying Jesus when he was a baby over a river. And it's also the patron saint of travellers and like exploration and things like this. And, you know, so why is there this strange connection with giants, with Salisbury, and discoveries have been found there? And you've got Stonehenge called the Giant's Dance. Is it all just coincidence? Is it all just kind of like myths and stories? Or is Thomas Eliot making it up? We also have another one in Salisbury just down the road of a 9-foot-4-inch skeleton being found in 1719 in a mound that was called the Giant's Grave. And so, you know, what do you make? I don't know what to make of that. It's like one of these, it's too many of these little things. So we just bring all the data together, and we're not pushing it on anybody. We're not convinced by a lot of it, but we are absolutely think it's a great story, and people should have a look at what is being compiled and make up their own minds.
Well, I think what you'd really like is that, you know, see top of the BBC and CNN, giants found, you know, they officially existed. So you know, a lot of the book in Giants on Record, you talk about how many of the skeletons are found in mounds, you know, the burial mounds and that kind of stuff. Surely many of those unexcavated mounds still remain, and probably are they being excavated now? Do you know?
They were finding 7-foot skeletons up until the 1980s, I think, in North America, I think it was Oklahoma.
Well, but why does it stop? I mean, you know, dinosaur bones are still being found, you know, regularly all the time. Why aren't giant bones still being found?
Well, they found the dragon man skull, which is very interesting in China. Well, you know, it's been around for a while. But maybe they are being found. You know, that's the question. I mean, not everything gets reported upon.
Why would it not be reported upon, though?
I don't know. That's one of the big question marks that we keep kind of challenged by. We don't know. We don't know why more of this isn't just public domain. Why isn't it just out there? But we don't know. And we're at a point where we're just pulling it all together. And we just want to kind of demonstrate that there's something here that's worth looking at. You know, whatever you believe, whatever the academics say, we just wanted to kind of just pull all the data together, analyze it as closely as we could, especially in relation to the myths and the stories, because we believe there's a lot of truth in them. And I think, you know, if you look into the myths and the stories, often they're passed down very specifically, you know, very accurately, and they're deliberately rhymed so they don't get forgotten, so the same words are used, and they encode lots of information and histories, which is often overlooked. And I think that's one of the areas that it's worth checking, you know, worth people to look at more.
Well, you know, having read your first giant book, Giants on Record, I find the evidence absolutely compelling, and I agree with you. Something is going on. There is definitely something going on. But I, you know, in order to convince other people who are maybe, you know, just listening and haven't heard of this, that there are not just the lack of skeletons now. So we have this Nagra thing. So they all got disappeared. But until that time, they're all hidden away and not being shown out, not being, you know, they didn't unleash the horde of skeletons upon the public for some reason. We also have a lack of photos. I mean, there's one photo, from 1899 of, it was Frederick Cook. You put that on my dad's site, I think, and that's pretty compelling. He talks about there being a tribe of, 7.5-foot giants or something like that. But you know, from the mid-1800s, we got loads of photos of Geronimo, you got loads of photos of different Native Americans. Why have we not got more photos of giants?
No, there are a few. There are quite a few. Yeah, I mean, we put them in the book, the ones we found anyway. We think it's partly because I think from 1990, the Nagpa thing, it's illegal to even have photos published of them as well.
Oh, my God, what?
Yeah, it's serious. They're really serious about this. And it's not just Native Americans, it's the federal government. And so we think that was partly responsible for getting them out of publications that had them in before that. And so they had to republish them and things like that. So that's why we think they were so hard to get. If we'd been doing it before 1990, it might have been a different story. But we've been contacted by people who claim they've got stuff, but they're scared to send us photographs.
Why?
Because it's illegal. Because they could get arrested if anything comes out about them having any bones or any photos of stuff like that. I mean, we went to see a gentleman, myself and JJ, 2 years ago in California, South California, going over to the Arizona area, and he claimed to have bones of a giant skeleton, and we went to see them, we witnessed them, we saw them, but he said that the only reason he could show us is because someone had classified them as bear bones, like the bones of a bear, and that's the only reason he contacted us, because if they had been classified as human, they would have been taken away, he would have been arrested. Because he found them. And he found them in an area where we know a 12-foot giant was unearthed in the early 1800s near Lompoc in Southern California. So we went to see them. We photographed them. This was after the book came out. And we're concerned because if they end up being human, then we could get in trouble as well. So we haven't even published it, you know, because we're concerned about that. But we don't know if they're human. We can't even really, in America, we can't get them analysed legally. You know, it's not a thing you can do. So there's a big problem there, you know. We've stopped researching in America. We just stopped
Outside of the United States, I mean, for example, in your book, you got, a huge number of stories from North America. They're also the Mayans, the Aztecs, they were great at chronicling their knowledge of the world around them. They must have explored and known about giants if they were in North America at the time. Why aren't there like codices full of stories about giants? Or are there? Maybe there are.
There are, yeah. There are. There's a Codex Vaticanus that shows a bunch of locals defeating a giant, killing him, cutting his guts open. It's pretty rough. We've got something like 20 accounts from Mexico, maybe 25 that we've just gathered over the years. 10 foot tall, some of them. There's legends of the Quinametzin. These are or the Quinines. These are like a race of giants who existed in one of the earlier phases before the Olmecs, you know, and the Olmecs in some traditions were the ones who defeated them and actually took over the land. And these are depicted, these are talked about in tradition. Cholula and Teotihuacan were built by a race of giants. The Quinametzins were the builders and the architects. And so you have that in north, very northern part, almost at the US border, you have the area of the Sonora Desert. And you have the Yaqui tribe, which is, I think, Carlos Castaneda and all that. But there's other tribes up there who, and it was reported by someone called Paxton, I forget the surname, in late 1800s, early 1900s, where they found these mummified remains of 7 to 8 foot tall skeletons reported on by us. He was part of the Smithsonian, but they never got into their publications. He just published it himself and put it out in all the news. We did a whole chapter on the Sonora Giants, I think, in our Giants on Record book. So you have got stuff going on in that part of the country. There's been giant remains found in Baja California as well, as well as there's a few accounts in the Yucatan. There's apparently a very tall skeleton on display in a museum near Copan in Honduras and things like this. And so you seem to find it everywhere. You know, there's lots of these accounts, there's lots of these stories, there's lots of these skeletal remains reported in the press, in academic journals. It's the same principles everywhere. And so it is there as well. So I don't know about them going into North America and writing or talking about stuff like that, but there's, I think, one of the most compelling, the way of looking at it is these early explorers going in, you know, and actually witnessing them and writing about them and experiencing them. I mean, there's a story even of them trying to sort of kidnap, I think, some giants and bring them back to Britain or Europe, but they died on the way back. And why didn't they keep the bones?
I guess a rotting body, yeah, on a small ship, a
bit smelly, you know. And so you got, you know, crazy stories like that. So yeah, so to be honest with you, we don't know a lot of it. We just don't know how authentic these are, but we kind of feel compelled to piece it together and investigate them as closely as we can, because there's a great story there.
That there is. And well, one of the stories in your book that I found quite interesting, it was a Texas Ranger, Nelson Lee, and he wrote a book about how when he was captured by the Comanche, he lived among them, and they told him their stories, and they were talking about how before them, there was a race of white-skinned, bearded, 10-foot giants.
Yes.
Take away the giant part, and it sounds a bit like the story of Atlantis. Is that kind of your supposition, that perhaps the Atlantean myth and the giant stories are one story together? Or?
Well, I mean, Jim Vieira, he's the Atlantologist around here. He's not here at this present moment, but he's convinced. I mean, if you look into that, I mean, if you look into the more metaphysical side of it, the more kind of theosophical side, they all these kind of traditions they have, you know, these esoteric groups talk about there were giants in Atlantis. Edgar Cayce talks about this. You've got the Theosophists and other people, and they were around. They were like that's where it all began, kind of thing, and then they emerged in different parts of the world. But I don't really personally go along with that too much. There's some elements of it which fascinate me, the mythological sides of it. But if you look in North America, I mean, you have not just them talking about this previous civilization, there's other myths, other stories of these Native American tribes. And this is Ross Hamilton again, and Vine Deloria Jr., who's an absolute genius. He was a Native American scholar and writer and activist here. He was a mentor to Ross Hamilton, who's been our mentor. So we've got this kind of interesting kind of feed of information that's been collected like orally over the years. And they talk about, and you can see this in the historical record as well, these lots of accounts of these fierce, red-haired or black-haired, bearded, very pale skin, often with freckles and ruddy skin, especially in the western parts and some of the northern parts of North America. And some of them going back, we're talking over 10,000 years. And they would terrorize the locals. We have the whole story of the Paiute tribe up in Nevada, and they were terrorized by these giants called the Saitika, which translates as either tool eaters or flesh eaters, according to some accounts. And they were around Lovelock Cave, and there's a whole story that they got burnt out, they got destroyed by all the locals because they were being eaten, literally eaten cannibal style by them. And then they found a whole bunch of skeletons that backed this up, a whole bunch of bones, mummified remains, that later on, you know, hundreds of years after the myths had been written down, you know, so you get things like that. And you've got petroglyphs up in that area called the Winnemucca petroglyphs. And these are huge, supersized, really high up places, these giant, beautifully carved petroglyphs. And they're up to 14,000 years old. So who was carving them? You know, we have to question that. And traditionally, that was the area of where the giants lived and resided before the Paiutes came in, you know, a couple of thousand years ago or so. So, yeah, things like that are really, really interesting to me. But also, we're finding connections, a lot of connections between North America and Britain. You know, JJ Ainsworth, who's been doing some brilliant research, and she's found the petroglyphs at Winnemucca, which are this super ancient date, are identical to ones found in the Boyne Valley of Ireland, specifically Loch Rue. And like, how is this possible? There's five or six exact symbols that design, almost like the same hand put them together. Well, the ones in Winnemucca are giant-sized and much older. And the descriptions of the people from the area the Paiute talked about, they seem like they're giant Irish people. And you got other tribes like the Duhair and I think the Carolinas who have like elements of the Welsh and Irish in their language. And so you're finding these strange connections. There's even an account we put in the new book where Christopher Columbus, when he was in Galway, Ireland, like 5 years before he set sail to America, he witnessed two extremely tall Native Americans, and they were described as robust, extremely tall. We've got all the data in here. And this is from Christopher Columbus's diaries, for God's sake. And they worked out that they floated over on a raft from America because the way the, you know, the sea, you know, brings people over from certain directions at specific times of year, the currents, they just easily made their way over here. And so we couldn't believe it when we found that out. So what's going on there? Does that prove that there may have been earlier kind of people coming over easily from America and actually influencing people in Britain? Another thing in Ireland, in the Ulster region, Northern Ireland, we find something called the AIP gene. This is similar to the whole gigantism, acromegaly type thing, but a bit different. And they found this specific area where people like Charles Byrne and many of the living giants from the last few hundred years come from. And still today, that's the tallest people in Europe emerge from this specific spot in Ireland. And it's still prevalent there. But they say it began at least 2,500 to 3,000 years ago, this gigantism suddenly started appearing in this part of Ireland. And then you look at the myths of Ireland and it talks about these incomers called like the Fomorians, the Tuatha De Danann, Tuatha De Danann, I've been corrected on that, and like the Firbolg, coming in from these lost sunken lands to the west and bringing these arts of civilization with these giant genes. And there's proof that a giant gene emerged there 2,500 to 3,000 years ago. So you've got little things like that, which don't make sense, but the myths are kind of matching genetics almost.
Well, you were talking about the redhead tribes in North America and how they were cannibals and they sounded quite barbaric. Yeah. So you know, my dad's work has all been about this lost civilization, this progenitor civilization. Maybe it seeded the people in Ireland. Maybe it seeded the people in North America. Who knows? One possibility. But you know, this Comanche story, this guy Nelson Lee, he talks about this lost race of giants as being very highly advanced, you know, much more advanced than the Europeans who'd come in to displace the Native Americans. Does that seem to be true based on what you've seen around all of these giant skeletons and you know, your research into giants? Were they an advanced people? Or were they pretty much on par with their you know, regular height peers at the time?
Well, in America, I mean, you've got, it's all different. I mean, you've got some areas like the whole Saitika thing in Nevada. They seem to be cannibalistic terrorizers. There's also these traditions in the Uruk Mountains and in California of these stone giants who had such tough skin, it was like it was made of stone. So you fire an arrow at them and it wouldn't penetrate them. And so, and they think they actually did that by rolling around in like sort of, you know, rock dust to kind of rub it on their skin to make it really tough. And they would terrorize and eat the locals. And like, and there's numerous myths and legends that talk about this. And then you have other areas like the Mound culture people, some of the early Mound, the Adena specifically. They were very sophisticated groups of giants, tribes of giants, elite groups who would, as I mentioned, were breeding between other elite groups who were very sophisticated into astronomy, geomancy, geometry, laying out things in the landscape, harmonizing the whole kind of landscape, affecting the weather, bringing rain through different dances and ceremonies and shamanic practices. So you got that, and you got the kind of cannibalistic tendencies in different areas and different times. Same thing in Britain as well. We have all these stories of like Gog Magog and these cannibalistic giants and other such things. But at the same time, you've got like the giant Idris, or you've got like the giants of Stonehenge who were like master builders and surveyors and like trying to bring harmony to the land and feed their people and like were renowned kings and leaders. So you've got like the same principles. You've got all these kind of, they're different, you know. You get like the very advanced and you get the very kind of savage aspects documented through mythology and also being proven through some of the kind of archaeology as well.
So you have you know, so many stories from North America of these giants, but also, you know, across the world. I don't know whether you found giant skeletons in the rest of the world, but there are stories of giants in the rest of the world. I mean, the Norse have the you know, the Vikings, they have the Jotuns. In Greece, we have the Titans and the Cyclops, and then the Anunnaki in Sumeria. And then in the Bible, of course, we got all these stories. You talked about the Canaanites before and the Anakites. And I know in your book, you've got a list a mile long of giants within the Bible, both tribes and individuals. There's the notable ones, Gog and Magog, Goliath, of course, King Og with his 13-foot bed, all that kind of stuff. The most interesting part of all of this giant stuff within the Bible is the Nephilim. So what does it say? The sons of God mated with the daughters of men. What's your take on all of that? Is your take that this was, you were talking about, what was it, the Homo
Heidelbergensis. Heidelbergensis or Heidelbergensis, yeah.
Is your take that they or the Denisovans or something like that were the Nephilim that were mating with the humans?
I don't know. I don't think the Nephilim are Denisovans or Homo Heidelbergensis or Heidelbergensis. I don't think they're the same. I think they're much older, a much, much earlier epoch. The whole story in the Bible is fascinating. I mean, we cover it briefly in our previous, but we talk about it in the new book because we think there are connections between that area and this area, with the fact that there's stone circles in both areas, there's dolmens in both areas, appears to be a Canaanite Saint Christopher very close to Stonehenge, a tradition that goes back to the 1400s. But with the whole story of the Nephilim, what's interesting about them is that they were the offspring of the Watchers or the Anunnaki, specifically the Watchers, who are the second or third group who came down from Mount Hermon or came down from the sky in some traditions, bred with human women. And they were the original Anunnaki, the kind of Enlil and Enki, became frustrated with these Watchers because they were interacting with humans, giving away all their secrets. And these secrets include things like the secrets of agriculture, mathematics, geometry, astronomy, metalwork, stone architecture, construction techniques, things like this. And they bred with these human women, apparently, gave birth to these Nephilim, who then became this even larger race, these very tall, robust, powerful, but also unruly, savage, and cannibalistic as well. And these were the ones who continued and took all this knowledge and gave it to humanity. And the Watchers didn't want that. The original Anunnaki didn't want that. So this is in according to proper translations, they claim that this is why the flood occurred, the Great Flood. It was to delete and get rid of the Nephilim. We have almost exactly the same tradition of Viracocha in South America, where he created a race of giants from the earth to help build the megalithic sites, but they became unruly, cannibalistic. He created a flood and destroyed them with that. So you get the same stories in different areas. We have flood myths in Britain as well, linked with giants, the same kind of thing. And so it's thought that some people suggest, we don't really promote this idea, but some people have suggested that the Nephilim then fled, the survivor Nephilim fled and spread the megalithic building knowledge, and their genes ended up in Britain and other places like North America. That's the kind of story that some researchers have put forward. We kind of, there's elements of it that make sense, but that's not the whole story. It's one part of the giant story, in my opinion. So if they were real, if these stories are true, then that would make sense. And so, but again, you have to take these stories seriously, in my opinion, especially things like the Book of Enoch, because he was like documenting what was going on. He wasn't just, I don't think he was making stuff up too much. And there's even talk of them coming, you know, the Watchers bringing over Enoch to Britain, potentially. And even according to Robin Heath and the authors of Uriel's Machine, they believe that actually they were at Stonehenge, possibly building Stonehenge and making observations from it. Even Newgrange as well. We have similar kind of stories of these people arriving with this knowledge and everything else. And so it's very odd, you know, when you start looking into these stories. I mean, it's hard to prove anything, you know, because there isn't archaeological evidence. But DNA and genetic movements across the planet are starting to reveal that there are connections with these different parts of the world.
Well, the activities of these giants, you were talking in your new book, is about how they seem to be building megaliths. Now, you obviously, was it say your T-shirt? Is that Megalithomania?
That's Stonehenge.
There you go. Yeah, Megalithomania. So you host this Megalithomania conference. You're obviously fascinated with megaliths. So is your supposition that the giants were building Stonehenge? You were saying they built Teotihuacan. Is this same myth kind of everywhere in the world? You know, in Japan, the Jomon megaliths, were they also built by giants? Or, I don't know, there's megaliths in every part of the world. Is this story common, or is this unique?
It's surprisingly common, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it is just people trying to understand, because they've kind of lost the actual truth of who really built them. So they kind of suppose, well, it must have been built by giants. Who else could have done it? That's the general thinking of academia about why they're called that. But you actually we've actually got giant skeletons being dug up in some of these places. You know, that's where it gets weird. Actually, inside stone circles, like Glenquicken in Scotland, for instance, they found a giant skeleton inside the stone circle, buried deep under it. And we're like, whoa, that's strange. And so, yeah, these myths of them creating the sites are very strong everywhere. And we're not just talking about them being the architects and builders, but actually, they encode stories in the myths of how they did it and how they placed them across the landscape, the geomantic principles, where there's a giantess myth that we find all over Britain and in other parts of the world, of the apron full of the giantess, where she would begin her journey going to another spot she was supposed to be going to, but she'd get disturbed or she'd get trip over, or apron strings will break and the stones will fall at specific spots along this dead straight alignment, and that's where that site was built. And so they're encoding the way they're placing the sites in the landscape in these stories, and often they're into triangles, very specific numbers and distances encoded within these stories. And so when you've got things like that, you kind of have to take note, you know, were there, you know, with the big question, did giants really build them? You know, perhaps, you know, if there were giants around, if they were actual, you know, they're going to be super strong, much more robust. They can easily carry stones compared to the little people, the normal sized people. So that's the basics of it. They could have done that. And there's just, I mean, I think something like, I mean, as far as we're aware, the amount of stories, creation stories of sites are linked with giants is like, I think, more than any other theory, you know, any other folklore story. And so, you know, why would that be? Is it just so they can just explain it's the only way they can think of it could have been done? Or is there something else in that based upon what we've uncovered?
Well, you know, these megaliths, you know, whether it was giants or not that were building them, the effort that goes into building them is, you know, absolutely staggering. You know, they're big, heavy stones, and they obviously had a really good reason to build them. all over the world, but it's really not obvious what that reason is. You know, the could it be just a sacred space for worship? Maybe, but the, you know, the typically the indigenous people who are around at the time, indigenous animistic beliefs were prevalent, and animistic belief says that, you know, that special rock over there is sacred, that waterfall is sacred. If you have that, why do you need to go and build a giant place like Stonehenge if you've already got a sacred waterfall or a sacred rock? So, you know, if they're already perceiving them in nature, what the hell were they doing building them? What do you think is going on? Whether it was people or giants, what's your take on?
Well, yeah, I mean, the use of these sites is what you're talking about. I mean, and why they would bother doing it, because it's such a task. I mean, you look at the pyramids. I mean, for God's sake, I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, that they did it, though, and they wanted it to last. And I think that's one of the reasons is that they wanted them to last, to be monuments to their skills, to their culture at the time, because they knew, they probably foresaw, like Idris did, that things won't survive. Our culture won't live on forever. Something will decimate us and remove us from this, the historical timeline, not just, you know, old age, but actually the whole culture will go. And so they wanted to record where they were at inside these temples that they would also use at the time, obviously, for ceremonies. They would use them as astronomical kind of, you know, devices. They would use them, I think, as well to attract and stimulate energy at these sites, because they understood the principles of geomancy and earth energies, and it would become agricultural fertility generators. And so these were built with compassion for future generations to be able to use them. And so I think there's also, they were like marker points on a trackway system across the country. They were used for navigation. They were used for multiple different purposes, I think, and this would depend on the individual culture's kind of primary needs at the time. And I think they were practical, and I think they were kind of spiritual and ceremonial all at once.
So you said that they were built with compassion for future generations to use them. Now here we are as inheritors of these things. What do we do? How do we use them? What do we?
Well, I think it's a case of, like, you know, If they're smart enough, which they were, they weren't gonna rely on the language they were speaking to last to communicate through time. You can only really communicate, I think, through time through things like mathematics, geometry, geodesy, which is the placement of where it is on Earth in the landscape, because they clearly could measure the Earth, that's without doubt, and also they're generators of energy. And so as long as the Earth spins and the sun rises, there's going to be energy available and light. So these were designed to manipulate and expand that energy. And it wasn't just, this has been proven actually by John Burke and Michael Persinger and other researchers, that the energy that can be manipulated and created in ancient sites and still are today, you know, often there's rock art sites where it's marking a spot where there's a high magnetic energy and it affects your pineal gland and you have visionary consciousness expanding experiences. But the fertilizing energy being produced by these sites is also affects your consciousness. It's the same kind of thing. It's the same energy, but has different effects on seeds and grains as it does on the human brain and pineal gland and so forth. And so I believe that they were to expand consciousness and to keep consciousness at a higher level, because they knew there were going to be dark periods in Earth's history where it would go down and then come back up and things like this. So it was their way of saying, this is where we're at, this is the peak we reached, try and stay there, people, in the future. I think that may be part of it. And I think these giants weren't just, you know, even if whether they were giant human beings or whether they were giants, you know, in skill, wisdom, intelligence and other such things, they may have been revered because of what they knew. You know, and I think that's why they may have been called giants in some cases. They might not have been physical giants, but they might have been as well, you know, because you have so many kind of all this evidence kind of congregating linked with these sites.
So, Hugh, this has been, you know, a fascinating discussion, fascinating stuff in the books. It's incredible, the idea of this, and you've done an incredible job putting it all together. You know, I'm excited to read your new book. I haven't, just as a last thing, is there anything in there that you'd like to, you know, to say about...
In this book, you mean?
In this book, that exact book.
There's, the new one. To be honest with you, there's a ridiculous amount of stuff we've compiled into this book. It's taken us like years to put that together. And I think we covered some good stuff. I mean, I think I'm fascinated by the geomantic aspect. I think that's one of the primary things we've kind of pulled out of all this stuff. But we have to credit Anthony Roberts. I want to mention him because he wrote a book called Sowers of Thunder in 1978. And he was the first to really put forward this idea that these giant myths and stories encoded this geomantic information, which could really start to be understood because of the study of Earth mysteries that had emerged in the 60s and 70s. And so we've taken that on. We've dedicated the book to Anthony Roberts, actually. He was a Glastonbury-based guy. He died in 1990. And so that side of it, to us, is very interesting. Something I'm working on with JJ as well as Jim, because we're finding so much with that we're able to trace it back to Mother Goddess traditions going back tens of thousands of years, potentially. And this apronful, this kind of mythos, there's a whole other element to that. So that side of it really gets me. But I think it's also a case of, like, we are, you know, we're very inspired by Graham Hancock, you know, just so you know. The way he approaches the ancient mysteries, trying to understand and unlock the secrets of this lost civilization, is something that's the kind of approach we take. We believe there's missing chapters in human history, and this is one of them. And so we're just kind of taking that approach. And like I said, and I think like Graham, he's not trying to force an idea upon you. He's not trying to kind of make you believe it. He's just presenting this amazing amount of research from all these different disciplines into one. And I think you can, I think that's the best way to do it. And I think, you know, we've tried to approach it the same way. And I think people are going to enjoy this book. I mean, some of it, we probably have too many accounts, but we wanted to make it comprehensive. We wanted to, like, put it all down, because we have maps of each area so people can go out to their giant sites. They can check out these graves of where this 15-foot skeleton was, this mythological figure was said to be buried. They can go to this museum where there was bones on display and things like that. So we think it's worth investigating, and we think there's more to come from ancient Britain when it comes to the giants and the connection with ancient sites.
I agree. Well, Hugh, thank you so much. And for people listening who are interested in this topic, please read Giants on Record and Hugh's new book, which I'm excited to read, Giants of Stonehenge and Ancient Britain, which should be a more comprehensive, updated version of the giant story. And honestly, Giants on Record was a really, really interesting, fascinating book. And I'm looking forward to read the new one. So thank you, Hugh.